Okay, I'm sorry we're a little bit late in starting, but I did open my mouth and I had a Romanian deputation on this question of wearing a veil in church, so that took a bit of time to deal with. Okay. If you open your mouth and put your foot in it, you've got to take your foot out, okay? Well, this gathering together is looking at the inroads of secular leadership concepts in the first century church. It has no relevance whatsoever to today, but we shall come to that later. Okay. I'm joking. Okay. And the safest thing to do is to look at Paul as the failed preacher, to try to decode or to understand what is being said in 2 Corinthians on this question about the Apostle Paul. Because I think this raises the issue of what was a very contentious issue in the first century, and it means something. Okay. 2 Corinthians 10:10 says of Paul, 2 Corinthians would help. 2 Corinthians 10:10 says of Paul, "For they say his letters are weighty and strong, but his bodily presence is weak, and his speech is of no account." That's what Paul's opponents are reportedly saying about him. Now, in the first century, that was a devastating thing to say of someone, that your bodily presence was weak and your speech was something that was ineffectual. Because there was a debate in the first century between letters and letter writing and the strength of letter writing, and the question of orality, the question of public speech. And that debate had gone on since the 3rd century BC with a man called Isocrates, who is discussing this issue, because there were some people who were very good at writing. They could write legal briefs, they could compose things very well, but they didn't look any good, because what happened was that oratory borrowed from the stage. And the word hypocrisis is the word for rhetorical delivery. That's what's being talked about here, from which you get our word hypocrites, meaning an actor. So what is happening, and it, you can trace it through in the time of Aristotle, it's beginning that business, that they begin to borrow the stage directions and actions, and they are using those for the public speaker. So the public speaker was a performer. And in order to be a performer, you had to have a very resonant voice, unlike mine. We mumble in Australia because of the dust and flies, but you had to have a very resonant voice. And what's more, you had to look good. So at the school, you would pump iron to become a beautiful guy, a Gucci guy, okay? Pump iron to build this lovely figure. And that's why the gymnasium was part of the secondary school education and the tertiary school education. And then as you got older, you had to look godlike, so they used pitch plasters, made of pitch, and they put over the body and they'd tear all the body hair off, so that your legs, your arms, your chest, you looked like a Greek god, like the statues. There was no place for the hairy man on stage. Okay? And you also wore designer clothes. You had to wear these lovely clothes because you had to look godlike. So this is what is called hypocrisis. First of all, how you looked. Now, if you looked like a wimp, okay, or like a weed, and you didn't have a body like that, they kept you writing these things you could write stuff, but they never allowed you to go on stage because you just didn't qualify. Okay? So that is the ancient world. So it wasn't sufficient that you were trained in school and you'd learnt all the writing in what's called the grand style of oratory. You also had to look good, and then you had to be able to speak in a with a voice and with actions. And like Flanders and Swann said, always be sincere whether you mean it or not. In this case, you had to look sincere and you had to look the part. So it was more like an acting that went on. And with the rise of the second sophistic of the orators, which occurs in this time, what you're having now is that the orators have come back. The philosopher has been replaced. In education, the orators are kings. And if you were an orator, you needed three things in order to persuade people. You needed pathos. You need to be able to play on people's feelings in your speech, evoke emotion and things like that. Okay, pathos. You had to have ethos. You had to sound authentic. So you were acting out a part if you were delivering a speech, some great speech or something. So the actions that were very important, they had to be coordinated. You had to be well rehearsed. And then last of all, you had to have all the tricks of oratory, what is called epoptasis, the business of the proofs type of thing. So it wasn't just good to have a good script. You had to look good, you had to sound good, and you also had to have a convincing argument. Now, when Paul went to Corinth, according to 1 Corinthians 2:1, he did not come, we are told, with the persuasive words of wisdom and of oratory. Because when you first came to a city, you nominated what you were going to talk about. No, sorry, you talked about yourself, you talked about the city, it was called Prolalia, and then they nominated the topic and you got up to speak. And you had to speak on that topic. You had sometimes had 24 hours to deliver another topic, to put the thing, and you had to learn it by heart. It had to be something tremendous. Now, the megastar gas bags of the first century could usually speak on anything, and so they were used to having all these prepared things. And if you succeeded, then of course you got all that the parents want to send their son to your school. And that means big money, because unlike the philosophers who didn't charge, the orators charged big fat fees like Cambridge, Oxford and other places do. Okay? Now, when Paul comes, he said he was with them in fear and trembling, etc. And his arguments were not in the persuasive words of men's wisdom, his kuruma. Why? Because so that people's faith did not rest in the wisdom of men, but the power of God. So when Paul comes to Corinth, he comes as the anti-orator, the anti-sophist, because he doesn't want to draw attention to himself. He says in 1 Corinthians 1:17, when they're preaching, it was not in the rhetoric he used for preaching. This was the grand style of oratory, highly stylized, and people were more concerned. Well, they were not concerned with content, because you paid fees to get into the theatre to listen to someone give orations. So there were public declamations, as they were called. And you also trained the young men to become lawyers, etc., to learn to talk. Now, that is the world that Paul is there. And because Paul is a public speaker, the question is, does he adjust his message to suit the medium, or does the medium have to suit the message? And Paul made a choice to come as the anti-orator to Corinth. Is the starting point, yes.
But now maybe time to ask you why you translate it's heavy and weighty as ineffectual. It seems like postmodern commentators kind of draw a contrast to today there. I don't have it right in front of me, but heavy and weighty versus disappearance or what have you.
No.
It sounds like you're saying that heavy and weighty is really a negative thing, whereas modern translations make it sound like a positive thing.
Well, I think his letters are weighty, so they recognize it packed a punch. Because you read Paul's letter, and it's like putting Semtex under your chair on issues. You're blown out, see? So they recognize the authority of his letters, but of course, they're the sort of people you keep in the back room. On the other hand, the pretty boys, the Gucci guys, you have them on stage and they're the people who are going to be the preachers. Like in America, you have jock preachers, okay? 2.5 kids, lovely wife, big car, $1,000 suits, pump iron, all those sorts of things. And these are the entertainers. It's theatre. Well, I shouldn't say that, but it looks like theatre to me anyway. Okay, when I go there. But what they are doing is that they are being very critical of Paul. And this is, remember, that Paul has already spoken about the fact that his task is to demolish every citadel that rises contrary to the knowledge of God. And this is the citadel that he is now demolishing. The citadel that, in order in the church now that Corinth has had Apollos, who is a good speaker and things like that, 1 Corinthians 16:12, let's have him back. Paul says, no way, Jose. And therefore the church, I think, doesn't want Paul to come back. And he's going to come back. And why do they want him back? Well, he looks like a wimp and he looks like a weed and talks like a wimp. And the traditional view of Paul was that he had bow knees, hook nose, and also he just didn't have it. Poor guy. But he was good at writing. We recognize the letters. Nothing wrong with his letters that he writes. But the reality is he doesn't measure up to the first century public speaker. And the church has to have a good image. Now, this is part of the thing that Paul is dealing with. And he has got to pull down this citadel because it means in future that you can only have Oxbridge people in the pulpit. People have been to Oxford and Cambridge. You can only have people of tertiary education in the pulpit. And also, they have to pass the body test, how they look. And they have to be really entertaining preachers to hold the crowd. And where's this come from, this new qualification? From the pastoral epistles? No, it hasn't come from there. Teaching of Jesus? No, it hasn't come from there. Old Testament? No, it hasn't come from there. Where's this come from? It's a Trojan horse that's come from outside. And it's been wheeled by the Corinthians. And remember that Favorinus and other people have very famous orators who've come to Corinth. And they love the orators who wow the crowd. And the church has decided, well, if we are a public, in one sense, a public meeting, we've got to have these sorts of guys because this will help our image in terms of the preaching. And we like it anyway because people paid for entertainment. So why not have good preaching on a Sunday morning with these guys, with their bodily presence and their great speech? So the word we have here is the word that's borrowed from the theatre. This is what we're looking for. I was somewhat amused to discover in one of the Pucker American evangelical colleges that they use Aristotle on rhetoric to teach their people how to argue, etc. And I thought that was very interesting, but let's pass on. Let's not get too close to the bone. Okay. So the question of how you looked and how you spoke was the central issue in the first century. And this is the rise of the second sophistic. And Philo says this was spreading like wildfire throughout, from the time of Augustus, throughout the empire. And this is what you needed. In fact, in Rome, there were people who gave great speeches, and it was in Greek, and most people couldn't understand it, but they still loved to go along because it sounded good. In fact, Augustus brought a whole stack of orators from Alexandria, and he had them in the first century. He wanted them to be in Rome itself. So it's quite clear that the Corinthians regard Paul as not qualified on the shortlist for the next pastor of the Corinthian church. Don't have the man back. That's their view. Now, Paul goes on to argue certain things. He talks about comparison, 2 Corinthians 10:12. Those who compare themselves and contrast themselves with one another, they have no understanding. Because what you find is that there is immense competition between teachers in the first century. Because their followers are called Matthetai, disciples, the same word that is used for Jesus' followers. And if you belong to this teacher and you follow him like a little poodle wherever he goes, you look like him, you dress like him, you talk like him as a clone or a clown, okay? That's what they are. And that's what happened. And therefore, you had to show that your teacher was better than that teacher. And sometimes it happened that someone would be walking in within listening ear to make sure that if they heard a teacher who slipped in terms of his Greek grammar, didn't use a atticizing term, a sort of a high-style term, he would then point the finger and laugh, because my teacher would never do anything like this. So you have immense two things that are said. You've got to be zealous for your teacher. You've got to be a zealot for the person you follow. And then also, you have to be competitive, that our teacher is better than yours. And of course, there was great competition between teachers. The word that is used, strife, is the word that's used, which of course Paul uses in 1 Corinthians about strife and jealousy amongst Corinthians, who seem to be saying, well, I belong to Paul. I belong to Apollos. And Paul said, this is idolatrous. I didn't die on the cross for you. You weren't baptized in the name of Paul, etc., etc. So already in the Corinthian church, within 5 years, people are beginning to conceptualize the church's ministry through the grid or through the lens of the secular world. And that's why they want their jock preachers. And they are playing Paul off, 1 Corinthians 4:6, they're playing Paul off against Apollos. And this is where the division has occurred. Now it seems to me that Apollos says he's not going to come back, and so the Corinthians, who are very innovative people, very avant-garde, they decide that they are comparing and contrasting themselves with one another, which is what is called synkrisis, comparison. We get another word in Greek called parabole. Parables are contrasting, those sorts of things. And they're comparing themselves with one another and contrasting themselves. And they've compared themselves with Paul, and they're all much better than Paul because their bodily presence isn't weak and that they're good gas bags when it comes to speaking. Okay? So that seems to me to be the setting of the issue in terms of 2 Corinthians. They are now conceptualizing ministry in terms of the what we call the sophists, the virtuoso orators of the first century. It would be very easy for that sort of thing to happen. So they don't want Paul back. So in this passage, Paul engages in some quite remarkable things. He shows that people who compete with one another in the ministry have no understanding. Okay, 2 Corinthians 10:12. He also goes on to state that he is not going to boast about other people's work. The implication is these people are claiming that the results in the Corinthian church are no doubt due to their recent arrival. And then he engages in a period of he says that, in fact, in 2 Corinthians 10:6, he says that he is a layman when it comes to oratory. The word idiotes, in which you get our word idiot, in the rhetorical situation, it means that he's non-practicing. You're a layman. You didn't practice oratory. Paul is quite clear about that. And then he goes on to this incredible section of boasting. And what's he boasting about? All his achievements? No. He's boasting about all the disastrous things that happens. And the message on this passage is don't go on holidays with Paul. Okay? Under any circumstances. If you go on holidays with Paul, you're going to have a real problem. Right? Because, you know, you travel on the ship and it sinks. Okay? You go on the road with Paul, you got robbers. And what is Paul doing here? It's a passage of great irony. He is boasting about all his disasters. These guys boast about all their achievements. But Paul is boasting about his disasters. And he says this. He swears an oath. Okay? And what is the oath that he swears in the end of chapter 11? He's going to boast about things, not that show me he's a jock preacher and a strong guy. He's going to boast the things about concerning his weaknesses. And he swears an oath. I promise you, he said, I'm not telling porky pies. I promise you, he says, that I am not telling a lie, that I will boast about the things that show my weakness. Now, Paul, of course, is engaging in a very countercultural argument. Because these guys are boasting about, look at my muscles, look at my designer under my boxer shorts, you know, Christian Dior. All the things they boasted about, those things, there's boasting going on, and Paul's going to boast about all the disasters. Now, it's very interesting because if you go to a place like Isthmia in Corinth, near Corinth, you'll see that people put on the wall all their achievements. The athletes have all their races they've won, a bit like cups. But there you see sometimes the inscriptions and other things, first in this and second in that, all the different games, and people would display all their achievements. Or you go to another part and they display all their public offices. We've been the president of the games, we've been the magistrates, we've been the the person who's in charge of the courts on civil actions, all those things. They lay them out on a stone. So it was a boastful society where you boasted about all the things you did because that gave you significance. So if you're athletic, you boasted. If you were someone in the public domain, and you would put up these inscriptions. And they even put statues up sometimes of people, and they carved the head, and when the person died, they pulled the head out, and they put another head in. So there was a good recycling process, okay? But all the time, you know, those who were the people who'd arrived and the great people, they were all there for public display. And what is Paul displaying? Well, he's putting it up on something there, and he says, three shipwrecks, so many beatings, robbers, the whole business. And he's boasting about his weaknesses and his failures. Now, we think that if the publishers got hold of this, they'd all be fighting for three volumes on Paul's missionary journeys. We think this is sort of heroic. But by first century standards, this is a disaster. But Paul is boasting because he wants to pull this whole image down about the preacher. This is his battering ram. He's going to sort of cause this whole big image of what we should have in the church to fall. Then he talks about the fact that when he was in Damascus, because when the orators came, of course, there was a big fanfare. The students went out to meet them. They were escorted. They went to the lovely hall. They announced what they're going to do. This was this man's arriving in town. What happens with Paul? Well, he's like a little rat. They let him down in a basket over the window and he rushes off to escape. And again, you can see that this is Paul's irony of his reversal. And if I'm going to boast, he said, nothing to be gained by it, he'll boast about the fact that he's had revelations. And that really is something. But what is given to him? A messenger in the flesh, because he discovers, and God teaches him a very important lesson at some stage of his ministry. He had a thorn in the flesh and we don't know what it is. If you know, then you're better than everyone else. We don't know what the thorn in the flesh was. I think there have been about 40-something solutions. He doesn't tell us, but he tells a much more important thing, that God plays to a Christian minister's weaknesses and not his strengths. God plays to our weaknesses and not our strengths. That is a very profound thing. Why? It says, God says to him, and it's in the perfect tense in Greek, and it will always be true, my grace is sufficient for you because my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, Paul says, when I'm weak, then I'm strong. Now, this is too hard to take on board for jock preachers. It's too hard for many of us to take on board as ministers that God plays to our weaknesses, not our strengths. He achieves his purpose because he's a very great God. As Paul says in 2 Corinthians 4, the treasure is in earthen vessels, so the surpassing glory is to see where it comes from God and not from the preacher. God doesn't wish to share the glory of his work and for other people to take credit. That's how it is. Why? Because as we move on in the passage in 2 Corinthians 13, Jesus was crucified in weakness, but he lives by the power of God. And for ministers, We are weak in Christ. That sounds wrong. There's no textual variant that says we're strong in Christ. We're weak in Christ, but in dealing with you, we shall live with him by the power of God. So here Paul has been quietly pulling down this, as it were, this cultural edifice in the ancient world about the image of the sort of person who should the Corinthians want to have as their next minister for their mega church, and they're already clearing the areas for parking lots, expanding the building, bringing in the choir, all those sorts of things, because they're going to establish a bigger church and they need someone who is appropriate. Because this is the posh colony of Corinth. It's the most posh city, as far as they are concerned, in the whole of the East, even posher than Athens itself. It's all been relayed, it's designed, its buildings are fantastic, etc., etc. So Paul is engaged here. We may not see it, but Paul here is engaged in a very considerable demolition of this edifice, this citadel, as to what sort of ministers we need for the church. And where has the model come from? It hasn't come from the Old Testament, the New Testament, the teaching of Jesus. It's come from the secular world. Okay? Any questions you want to ask on that before we press on? I'll talk about the hermeneutical difficulties later on, okay? Okay. But the message is, don't have him back. The answer is 2 Corinthians 13. This is the third time I'm coming to you. Every allegation that made against me has to be established before two or three witnesses. And if you want the proof that Christ is speaking in me, well, Paul says, remember that Christ was crucified in weakness. And so we don't have, Jesus did not join the ranks of the orators of the first century, the megastar orators. Okay? Yes. What he's saying is that people have made allegations against Paul. In fact, it's interesting because in chapter 12, they give the impression, it's in chapter 12, I've got a new I've left my old translation at home. I can't find it now. These verses keep disappearing, okay? Whereabouts is it? Yes. They said in verse 16, but Paul was crafty and got the better of you by deceit. Because what happens is the orators never collected the fees themselves, they sent their agents. And it seemed to me an allegation has been made against Paul that although he says that he never charges, there is a love offering at the door and you can't get out of the church until you've actually put something in the plate. That sort of thinking, you see. In other words, people have come for this collection, but it's going to be one for Paul, one for Jerusalem, one for Paul's administrative costs. That's the sort of allegation I think they're making, because the orators did the same thing. They sent their agents, the fees were incredibly big, but they didn't have the effrontery to actually gather the money themselves. So I think that there's also the allegation against Paul is that although he pretends in 1 Corinthians 9, he's high-minded, never charges, all those sorts of things, but he has got his buddies who come along and they're going to do some collecting, and he's crafty in the way he's operating. So Paul has said, when I come, he said, those who've made all these allegations will have to substantiate it, because in the Old Testament, you could never condemn anyone before two or three witnesses. In the pastoral letters, if you bring an allegation against a teacher, you've got to have two or three witnesses. And Paul is sort of saying, well, we're going to sort of straighten this whole matter out when I come. those who make the allegations, they will have to substantiate what they're going to say. And that's why Paul, as he goes on to say, you guys examine yourselves in terms of the church context. Yes?
Today, can the ministers list their weaknesses as part of all the new believers, whether the church will accept and appreciate the minister, that he is really a man or a woman used by God.
Well, what would you do in India if you were?
Well, in India, people will not accept. You know, you cannot simply list your weaknesses
yes.
for the church.
Good.
I don't know. Same situation prevails even today.
Well, see, I'm interested when you ask people, we're going through, because David Jackman, people have taken our minister office, we're going through the present issue of looking for a new person. And it's interesting when you read the profile that people have and you say, where has this profile come from? Because people have an image of the sort of minister they want. In America, 2.5, kids, nice wife, big car, $1,000 suits, and probably been to Harvard or Yale, PhD from Cambridge in certain places. There is an image of what people are looking for. Where has this image come from? Now that, to me, is the fascinating thing when you ask people, because we assume that everyone knows what the minister should be doing, except the minister, okay? Everyone should know what is would be the best profile, I think the word is called. What is the profile that is asked for? Now, I looked at some of the profile for the Southern Baptists, and I decided the Apostle Paul would never have got the short list of the preachers, because he just didn't measure up to the sorts of things. And where do these images come from? That's my question I want to ask, where the images have come from.
Just a question on his weaknesses. They are kind of quite heroic in a way, aren't they?
We think they are.
But is there no sense that, you know, this is...
No, it's not heroic in the first century. It means that in the thinking of some of the Corinthians, that really, if God does this to him, God's not terribly happy with him. God's beating him up all the way.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think, what would a Corinthian be today? My car broke down, persecution. You can understand it if you're in a persecution context.
Yes.
I was kicked out of this church, perhaps that would be more accurate.
Yeah, well, that lovely ad, there may be trouble ahead, you see. At least with Paul, there was trouble. Now, what I think it is, what Paul is doing is that these guys are boasting about how great I art. They sing the hymn, how great I art, O Lord my God, okay? That's what they're singing on one side, and they're putting all this up on the wall, you know? Church grew by 300% in 2 weeks. Stole other people's sheep. All the sorts of things they put on the wall there. Parking lots we can now accommodate. The church money, it's grown up like this. Okay? It's all the sort of boasting about achievements. So Paul says, well, I'll boast about my achievements. It's all about the disastrous things that happened to him. So it's a passage of great irony in one sense, because, you know, he's cutting them down to size, and all that'll be left is their ankles by the time he's finished. There's nothing more with Paul. But these, and they think that, you know, they know the sort of minister the church that they need in the church. And where they got it, the Trojan horse, from the secular world. And that's where the concept has come from. And that's why Paul is saying we have to demolish every argument and every high thought that rises contrary to the knowledge of God. And I tell you, these guys, they're not even standing in their socks anymore. Because Paul has pulled down this great edifice. And this is an example of what Paul has done. We think it's perhaps highly amusing. And I think, are you about to take my photograph?
Yes.
Oh, right, okay. Just wait till I look like the wonderful... Okay. I just want to look the part, you see. Now, you let me know when you're ready, because, you know, it's got to really, you know, this is very good. It's got to look like this, okay. I haven't got makeup on. You should have let me know, okay? Okay. And I haven't dyed my hair. Oh, wow, I forgot about that as well. Okay, right. You came in a very inappropriate moment, because I really wasn't ready for you, you see. And an image is everything. And you know what the wages of spin is, don't you?
Hmm?
The wages of spin? Spinning the image of who I am. Okay. So this seems to me to be sort of really quite a remarkable passage. And when you look at the evidence of Philo of Alexandria, you look at the discussions in the ancient world, and I don't say buy this book because it's not bedtime reading, but I've laid all that information out because I was very concerned to try to establish, well, what is really going on in this context? Because it does belong to something, and it seemed to me that we may not have too much hermeneutical difficulty in moving it into the 21st century. Because if we go back to the to 1 Corinthians, you see that in 1 Corinthians 3:3, Paul accuses them. He says they're operating kataanthropon in a secular way. They're behaving like anthropoi, like the ruddy pagans do. That's my dynamic equivalent. It just means, you know, like other people do. Okay? But they're behaving in a pagan way. And Paul says they're in diapers still. If I stand like this, okay? I must look pious. Always look pious whether you are or not, okay? Always be sincere whether you mean it or not, okay? I'll turn over this, are you helping? Hurry up, come on, take this photograph. Image is everything, you see. I'll try to look very serious, okay? Now, the Bible says, okay, that it's being recorded for me, okay? So Paul says in 1 Corinthians 3:1, I could not address you as spiritual men, but you were only babes. I fed you with milk and not solid food. You were not ready for it, and even now you're not ready. Why? Because you still are behaving in a fleshly way. For where there is jealousy and strife among you, are you not sort of secular, behaving like ordinary men? Why? For when one says, I belong to Paul, and the other one says, I belong to Apollos, are you not simply anthropoi, simply like ruddy pagans? Okay. Then Paul goes on not to talk about their personality. Who is Paul? Who is Apollos? But what is Paul? What is Apollos? So Paul is adopting a functional approach to ministry. He's using low status terms because he refers to himself as the guy who dug it and the gardener who watered it. But every time God made it grow. I planted, Apollos put out the watering can, but he says emphatically, God made the show grow. And he goes on to discuss this issue. So the fact that in 1 Corinthians 1:10 he refers to the same issue, that there are divisions among you because Chloe's people have spilt the beans, there's quarrels. And what's happened? Each one of you saying, well, I'm the Paul party, someone, I belong to Apollos. Is Christ divided? Was Paul crucified for you? And why was I sent? Christ sent me not to be like Jack the Dipper, John the Baptist, but to preach the gospel, not with the eloquent wisdom, but lest the cross of Christ be emptied of its power. Okay? So that's Paul's concern. It's possible to preach the cross in such a way, but the effect of the cross never grasps hold of people. And the megastar orators of the first century were incredible people. They could talk about anything and make it sound good, a bit like politicians. Turn a disaster into a victory just by the way you spin it. Okay. And when you look back and there were orators who said, you know, at the end of the speech, but praise me, praise me. And philosophers says, and I mentioned this the other day, that it was like their livers. If they were not praised, their livers shrunk. If they are praised, their livers swelled, the seat of the emotions. They felt good. And in one case, there was a big. It says that only 17 people turned up, and if anything 17 or less was a disaster for the first performance of an orator. And Epictetus says this business about how all this is going on and people are asking questions, but he said, "But praise me, praise me," because that's what they wanted, because the audience was their oxygen. And it was said of Palermo and others that when they walked on stage, there was a murmur of approval. They just looked godlike in the way, like the Hollywood actor or like the Gucci man. You see them on the things, you see? All the hair shaved off their legs, looking absolutely fabulous. And this is the image.
I just wonder if they had in the audience their followers who started clapping like they had
Well, what the enemies did one time of Palermo when he was applying for the chair of oratory in Athens, some of the enemies nominated a topic on which he had previously spoken. Now, you always had to give a new topic. But they had got printed copies because these guys published their orations. They'd got printed copy where he came from over in Turkey, and they brought it across, and as he began, when they nominated the topic, he just sort of launched straight off. And the guys in the front started reading it. The whole of the audience collapsed. He didn't get the job. He went to Rome, but actually got the chair of rhetoric in Rome. So God worked all things together for good for him, you see. But you can see that, you know, there's this tremendous competition. It was theatre, pure theatre in what happened. But the parents busted themselves to work on for their sons to learn to do this under these teachers because, you know, who is your teacher? You know? Public school boy, you've been to the right place, got the right ticks there sort of thing, and your career is launched to be a lawyer, to be something else, all those sorts of things, to perform in the public domain.
Did Paul, when he mentioned Gamaliel, did that have some of that flavour in it as well? Gamaliel was my teacher?
I think what he's doing in Acts, he's actually sort of, I suppose, not. I don't think it's so much the prestige, or the orator thing, but simply he was a very learned rabbi that Paul had worked under. The content mattered. Okay. Now, and you know in 1 Corinthians 9, Paul talks about the fact that he didn't exercise his rights, he did this for nothing. He didn't want to put a stumbling block in the way of the gospel. 1 Corinthians 9:12. How would him being paid money put a stumbling block in the way of the gospel? Well, he was a public speaker. He's like all the public speakers, like Jerry Maguire, show me the money when they came to the city. And that's what the concern was. And Paul was concerned. He did not want in any way. He didn't speak like the orators. He didn't talk like and act like the orators did. He didn't collect money like the orators. He did something awful. He worked with his hands. And what did the orators say of the first century? These hands have never known work. That's what they boasted about. And the passage in Philo talks about how they said, amongst the other things, were that they were rich, they did all these things, but these hands have never known work. And what does Paul do? Paul actually earns his own living. Because he doesn't want anyone to say, Paul is preaching the gospel because there's money there. Because when other people got up to speak with their message, they knew that there was money there. But Paul doesn't want that sort of thing said of him. You think that's remarkable? You know? Even though Jesus said you have every right to earn money, if the gospel was at stake in any way, that those who earn the gospel right to be supported by it, but if the gospel is going to be misunderstood in this particular culture, no way will Paul ever have any money. He will work with his own hands and he will support his own ministry because he doesn't want to look like those charlatans. Okay? Now, one of the other interesting things about Paul, which has always puzzled me, he never uses the word leader. Okay? In Greek, archon is the word. Now, it's very interesting that this is a very familiar term in the first century. If you do a run through on the inscriptions, there are literally thousands of examples of the use of the word archon, meaning the leader in the city. Okay? In fact, the synagogues, they borrow the term, and they have archisunagogoi. Because, in fact, in 1 Corinthians, in Acts, in Corinth itself, we've got some good evidence of what is happening there. Chapter 18. Because who comes across? Paul is sheep stealing, naughty boy. What happens? In verse 8, Crispus, the ruler of the synagogue. Now we know from an article produced by Tessa Rajak, who's a friend of mine, David Noy, discussing the question of archi-synagogoi, some of them weren't even Jews, but they were people of influence. That's fascinating. The evidence that some of them were not practicing Jews, they were not necessarily God-fearers, but they were people of importance. And the Jewish people, the Jewish synagogue, persuaded certain people that they could be the head of the synagogue because they needed people of power to connect with the cities because of anti-Semitism. But in any case, the Jews brought in archi-synagogoi. They had the head of the synagogue. They used that. Now, Paul never uses this term, which would be a natural term, in regard to his discussion about the people in the church. Why? Because what do you need to be one of these people? You need status. In other words, you need to be successful. You need rank. Whether you were senatorial, equestrian, all these sorts of things. Roman, citizen. So you need rank and status. And you need education. And you need to look like Arnold. Okay? To pump iron. Still amazes me how he became the governor of California. I'm still working that out. It still puzzles me. And I look at him and I reckon his chest implants are gone on there. No one could look like that. But anyway, it's a small matter. But he did learn to pump iron in London, actually, in England, in his early days. These are the sorts of things that you needed. Body beautiful, all those sorts of things. And Paul himself, he talks about himself. He's a gardener. 1 Corinthians 4:1, he refers to himself as the oikonomos. He is the steward of the mysteries of God. His task is to take out of the cupboard of revelation and according to the needs of the congregation, match what God has said with the needs of the church. So Paul is using functional terms, what is Paul, what is Apollos. He's using low status language to describe himself, but never once does he use the term archon for leader, which is really quite interesting. And why doesn't he? Because that's the Trojan horse. And the Corinthians have brought the Trojan horse into the middle of the church. And when they weren't watching, all these things spilt out into people's minds. And they began to reconceptualize what ministry was like in the church according to the latest model of successful leadership. That is what has happened. That's my reading of it. The Trojan horse has arrived. Okay. Now, when I was a young man in the days of Methuselah, we referred to ministers as ministers or servants or pastors. We used functional terms. And the word minister that derived from the word diakonoi was a word that was used of the household servants, the bonded servants, 7-year bonded servants. And something happened, actually. I know where it happened. In a place in America called Fuller, where they decided that they were setting up a department of ministry and leadership, and they would use any of the secular categories and secular programs and secular sort of perceptions to establish their department of Christian leadership. And I was there at the time, and someone said, I will not let you talk to those people. We've got to keep you away from them because they are borrowing any model they can find from the business world in order to structure their thinking about remodeling ministry. They must have known I was Australian. Anyway, it's a pity they didn't because I could have put them right. But what has developed is we've suddenly had a new change. We call it Christian leadership. Now, the interesting thing about Paul's leadership, and this is... Oh, I should turn this off now. It's being recorded. the thing about Christian leadership is, of course, leaders have followers. In the first century, leaders have clients. And the morning, when all the clients got there, they would be waiting down there, and the patron would come, and everyone would call him, "Good morning, sir, give the salutatio." And then when he walked up the road, they walked behind him in two by two, right through the thing. If he went to the courts, they went to the courts with him. And the more prestigious the client you had, the better. And so he had this idea of these were the leaders, and these are little poodles who run behind. When they went to the bars, the poodles went to the bars. When they came back for dinner, the poodles came back and got fed, and they were paid. And these were the followers. These were the mathetai of the leaders. So teachers had them. The patrons had them. And the leaders of the city, they had them, because these were the people who were involving in votes. Lovely thing in Pompeii. They're advertising for a new treasurer, and someone puts all the thieves are voting for this man, okay? Which I think is lovely, which implies that he's a crook, you see. So they had the dirty tricks in electioneering in those days. Now, this is I have a problem, you see, because if you ask people now about, we are having, this idea of leadership, have we wielded a Trojan horse into the contemporary Christian church by talking about leaders? Paul has no disciples. And what does leadership involve? It requires, I think, a course in Olympic gymnastics, I think, to persuade me that it's a very appropriate term to use. But I'm old-fashioned, I know, like Dame Edna. You know, call me old-fashioned because I am. But one of my concerns is that perhaps we ought to stick to biblical terms, because sometimes when we use outside terms, we can begin to wheel into it the Trojan virus that actually recolours our perception of ministers we want. Now, I was teaching at a seminary in the States, and someone said to me, "I've had three offers of churches." I said, "Well, I'm sorry to hear that," is my word of encouragement. "I'm sorry to hear that. You are going to have a problem because you're 6'4", you look like a jock, and you know in America what the jocks are like. You look like a jock, and everyone's going to want you to be their minister for the wrong reasons. And this is sad," I said. "It's just a pity you're so tall and so good looking, but it's going to be a problem to you for all your ministry." Because they looked at this guy, and I think, yeah, that's exactly the image. He hadn't opened his mouth. He hadn't preached a sermon. He'd done any of these things yet. And they were banging on his door to come and be the minister. Now, why? Okay. What's happened? The secularization of the Christian mind on this issue. Okay. And it's only going to get worse. You're going to have hair implants now, chest implants. You can, redo yourself, the whole lot. But you almost have to if you're a young guy, because that's the image. And where's it come from? It hasn't come from the Bible.
In the industry, it's very much that image. In the big companies, the leaders very often have these looks, very tall, more than 6 foot tall, and they're bearing very much, not everybody, but many of the ones in the,
yeah,
in the upper management.
Well, that is right, because they look at the Harvard boys, and if you're like me, Zacchaeus size, you haven't got a hope getting on. You're just the wrong size. Chest muscles are slipped, all those sorts of problems, and you're struggling in terms of what ministry's about. But the good thing was Paul wouldn't be invited either. Why? His bodily presence is weak, and his speech is ineffectual. Well, now we know it was the Corinthians made this mistake because they're only young Christians. We wouldn't do anything like that. Never fall into that trap, would we? I put a little note, actually. I can't find it. Some semtex at the bottom of my book about this issue. But anyway, if you look through, there's a sort of little bit of semtex for the church about the present images and things like that. So the secularization of first century Christian leadership, I put that in, I really like that, I felt a hypocrite putting the word leadership in, but anyway, the secularization, yes.
Bruce, in Romans 12, as well as translated as leadership, what is that word in Greek?
Just give me the verse, actually.
Romans 12:8.
It's not the word archon, it's the person who stands in the front. The man sort of who stands up, I presume, takes responsibility, okay, from the verb hysteri. Okay. But it's not the word archon, my relieved. Yes, okay. Now, we had a guy who came to our house in Cambridge with a chap called Mark Devers. Some of you may know him from the States. And this guy was 6'4", you know, and when Mark went off to Athens and to Corinth, you know, he just looked like some of the statues around the place, you see. Now, he went to one of the Pucker Orthodox seminaries in the States for an interview. And they said to him, "You're the sort of person we want here." And he made some inquiries as to why. And in the end, he discovered that this is the sort of image of the minister that we really want, that the church is looking for. And he hadn't opened his mouth. In effect, he hadn't said anything very much, but they looked at this guy and thought, yeah, this is the sort of guy we want. Well, now, where's that come from? It's come from the Gucci models. It's coming, you know, from the American football. Well, if he's in Cambridge, you know, he looks like a Sloan Ranger. He's one of the guys who brought up in Sloan Square, been to the right sort of places. And we are very vulnerable in terms of ministry, the people we look for. And we think, oh, he would go well. Haven't heard him preach, haven't heard him pray, know nothing about whether he's ever evangelized people, but we live in the age of images. And you know what the wages of sin is? Death for ministry. So I'm fascinated by this whole phenomenon that's grown up in which we have brought this term in. And with it, we brought, I think, the images. And we're not describing people in functional terms. But I read an article which says, who is Paul and who is Apollos? I imagine he flipped my lid. Because in the Greek it says, what is Paul and what is Apollos? What is their job? Okay? And when Paul talks about his ministry, he talks in terms of the issue of that he is an oikonomos. It's functional all the way along. And what's required of a steward? He should be faithful. And what are the Corinthians doing? They're playing Paul off against Apollos. Because if you look in Acts chapter 18, you will see that Apollos actually, in the way Luke's described him, was just the sort of man they wanted. Educated. What do they say about him? A Jew in Acts 18:24, a Jew named Apollos, a native of Alexandria, really a citizen of Alexandria, not a native, came to Ephesus. He was an eloquent man, anelogios, okay? A man of education, well-versed in the scriptures, been instructed in the way of the Lord, and when they describe the way he preaches, it's very interesting because he is someone who powerfully confuted the Jews in public, demonstrating epictetus, interesting word, from the scriptures that Jesus was the Christ. The Christ was Jesus. Now, this is sort of, in many ways, a description of who Apollos was, and you could understand why the Corinthians really wanted him back, for the wrong reasons. And they didn't want Paul back for the wrong reasons. So what I'm saying is, we've got this sort of image issue, and we have to do some very hard thinking, especially if we're training people for ministry, or recruiting people in colleges and these things. We've got to make sure that we get, we're not influenced by the secular world. And it is one of the problems for some of the guys going into ministry that, you know, in effect someone said, well, you'd only ever be a 40-member church pastor And the man looked me in the eye, because that's how tall he was. As it was explained to him by the professor of preaching, he recounted this story. And, you know, he hadn't been to Harvard or Yale, the right sorts of things. And I think this is disastrous. Because what are we doing? We're not asking, has Christ given his gifts? Ephesians 4. Christ the ascended King has given gifts, that some should be apostles, some should be pastors, some should be teachers, in order to be jocks. No, that the intention is that they should be for the perfecting of the saints, so that they can do their ministry in the world and they can build up the body of Christ. And, you know, we've got it wrong. So, and how long has it taken? Not very long. 1984, I was at Fulham. You go to the States, everyone has got a Department of Christian Leadership or something like that in it. And that's different in Europe and different in England, I'm sure. But you can see that the Trojan horse has come, been baptized in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. So it must be a holy Trojan horse. And we're struggling on the issue as to what sort of ministry we're looking for. And it could be the undoing of the evangelical scene, because we're not concerned about the question of, not is he a good preacher, is he a faithful preacher? What does good mean? Well, he helps our insomnia. If we've had it on Saturday night, we can stay awake for the sermon. And I heard a professor of preaching who was being installed in a seminary, and he preached on the passage 1 Corinthians 1 about preaching the cross not in the wisdom of men but in the power of God. And we heard about 20 jokes. I was counting them. We heard all this great sort of finely crafted sermon, and he sat down, murmur of approval, wow, we've got the best man to be our professor of preaching. And as we left the big church and went outside in the foyer, I heard some students saying, wow, isn't he a funny guy? And so, not being backward, I called out in a loud voice, when I leave church, I want to say, don't we have a great God? And silence fell on the multitude. Okay. Silence fell on the multitude. I kid you not, in terms of what that was all about.